three different headers today, if you'll allow me. Today, the entrance of a path to a little less self, a little more righteousness. That's for the churchy. For the socially conscientious, today, the entrance of a path to a little less self, a little more justice. For the philosophically minded, today, the entrance of a path to a little less self, a little more virtue.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
Normally, when we think about ethics, the idea of ethics, and I see this happen all the time. I teach ethics at Criswell College, where I'm the president. I have taught ethics for years, now decades, in higher education, in state settings, public university settings, and also in the private Christian setting that I'm in now. So I teach ethics, and I have noticed that when I bring up the topic at all, everyone sort of assumes that it is a tool that you, if they know anything about it at all, it's a tool that you use to stay out of trouble in your business dealings, or to talk about government conflicts of interest or things like that. And they think of ethics in this sort of simple, pragmatic way as a tool for keeping out of trouble. So I would put the difference this way. It's something like this. They're thinking of it, people, and this is because it's the way ethics is normally used. It's not the fault of those who are saying that. They say that because that's how it is. Oh, we're going to have an ethics class today, and here's how you avoid giving too much money to a vendor, and here's how you make sure that you don't create a conflict of interest when you're working as a public servant, and so on. In reality, ethics is much broader than that. How do we live together? What keeps us tied together as a society, even when the pressures that we face make us want to go in different or conflictual directions? And so what I would say is the way of understanding ethics in our commonsensical way, or at least the way we use it every day, is thinking of it as cautious driving or a tire iron. In other words, it's how to avoid a flat or how to fix a flat when you have it. But in reality, ethics is the road that we're supposed to go down. It is the path. And it's hugely important. The questions that ethics specifically dealt with from the beginning were the biggest questions in human existence. How do we live together? What keeps us together as a people, even when all the pressures that we face and the conflicts that we have start to fray the social fabric in one way or another? One of the earliest books that deals thoroughly with the concept of ethics is Plato's Republic. You've heard of the book, the Politeia. It has to do with the city-state, you know, how a polis, a Greek polis, city-state, would function. What makes it what it is? But the ultimate question that book asks, and I mean ultimate as in this is what it deals with throughout the entire book, but it's the question explicitly raised from the beginning of the book, is simply what's right and what's wrong. That's all it wants to know. It's entirely about ethics, the theoretical underpinning to what separates right from wrong, which is justice. That's the word that's used for it throughout that book in translations that you'll find. In biblical language, it's exactly the same word that we use for righteousness. That's why I gave the three different headers today. I mean, we like the churchy word righteousness, so we haven't obtained righteousness. And when we come to Christ, we obtain righteousness. And it sounds like this holy and ethereal transcendent quality of whatever. But it is the thing the entire world was trying to figure out how to obtain. What is it that makes us right instead of wrong? What is it that makes anything right instead of wrong, and therefore, how do we define the parameters within which we live with each other, within which we function as a society? That's what all of those questions are about. And so as Plato starts answering the question, this is not where he ends up at all, and I'm not going to teach all of Plato today, don't worry. I know, you could turn it off for that, but really, you shouldn't. It's a fascinating work, and one of the most important works, at least in Western civilization's history. So I encourage you to go read it sometime, Plato's Republic. With a little guidance, I would recommend a little guidance, but, you know, if you've read other philosophical works, it's worthwhile. Anyway, Plato's first approach to it is to say, well, you know, there are groups of people who come together and they just need a more effective way to survive, to meet their basic need for provisions. So they trade wares with each other, and you make shoes, and I'll farm, and I'll provide your wheat, and you provide the shoes I need for walking around in the field, and that way I don't have to spend my time trying to learn to be a cobbler, and you don't have to spend your time trying to produce wheat when all you really know how to do is work on shoes, and so on. And so we work together and produce a better society, and we could define what's right or wrong on what makes that work. We tried that for a while, but then we also need, and this is a sort of a synthesis and sort of a, you know, a breakout from what Plato does. So I know he doesn't address it exactly this way, but for laying down the concepts, this is what it amounts to. Then second, though, we learn that we have a need for protection as groups of people who've gotten together and are trading wares with each other. We learn that we have a need for protection from other bands of people who want to steal our shoes and take our wheat from us and so on. And so we end up with guardians of some kind. And they also help keep the trading honest. So if you're doing it, that you do it right. You said you'd deliver wheat for the shoes I gave you, but you're not giving me my wheat. So I call the guardian and he makes you give me the wheat and so on. So all of that fairness comes out of having these guardians in the society. And then finally, we have a desire for a little luxury in the Kallipolis, the whole or healthy or full city, sort of luxurious city type thing, where you have more than just subsistence going on. And because we pursue that, we end up needing something that will help us figure out how to cooperate with and live with each other and work with each other in the best way with all those different elements going on at the same time. And all of those concepts are really just utilitarian, but they do require agreement or cooperation. By utilitarian, I mean they're just to get to an end. I want to be able to live without fearing going hungry during the winter, and so I do all these things and so on. So that's fine. They require agreement. They require cooperation. But eventually, there develops a need for something more substantial than just the utilitarian outcome that we're able to survive. And we recognize a need for justice, which Plato puts into terms of a proper balance between moderation, courage, and wisdom. Moderation among the tradesmen and courage among the guardians and wisdom among the leaders of the city. But in the individual, the same things have to play out. You know, sort of a governing our appetites and governing our spirit and then governing our intellect. And when you put moderation and courage and wisdom into proper balance with each other as natural virtues, they produce righteousness or justice or virtue with a capital V, if you want to think of it that way. And it produces it for the polis as a whole, the city-state as a whole, and then also for the individual. Okay, I'm about to leave all that behind. That way of thinking about what's right and wrong, and let me tell you, the reason I want to bring all of this up is because of things that are going on right now in our society, in the way we respond to the provocations that we have with each other about what's right and wrong. So if you're watching a rally among the Republicans and your response to that is so negative that you're like, what are those people even talking about? Why do we even have those people in our society? Or if your response to a Democrat rally is the same, oh, why do we even allow those people to live in our country? Or if you're watching the January 6th insurrection, then and your response is, ah, no big deal. Or if you're watching the Black Lives Matters protests and you're saying, oh, no big deal, on either side of the meaning of that, then I would say to you on those opposite sides, all of us probably need to get a grasp of something different about our understanding of why and how we live together righteously, justly, virtuously in the society. And because we don't know what virtue is, we don't know what ethics is as a discipline. Yeah, the plural is a singular. Ethics is a singular. that we don't know what it is, then we don't know how to react when somebody starts telling us that we're not measuring up to it or that we could measure up to it. We just don't know what to do with it. And so I just want to lay down a simple foundation for understanding how to better respond to that. So to get to that, I need to give some history so that we can get up to understanding what it would mean to say to somebody, wow, you're not doing the right thing. Because while it sounds like an absolute insult, in reality, it's the only path forward, as I'll point out in a few moments. So as we leave Plato behind, take one generation forward from him and his student Aristotle, the idea of ethics, the idea of virtue matures a little bit. And they are the same thing at that time. The concepts of ethics and virtue just merge with each other. The words aren't identical, but the concepts are the same. And so what matures through Aristotle in this slightly different way is a way to achieve the essence that we've been given. That's the thing. And in Aristotle, in other words, ethics becomes this grasp of the difference between the way a thing happens to be right now and the way it would be if it fulfilled its essence perfectly. So for me as an individual, the question that my ethics has to ask is, what was I supposed to be and what do I happen to be right now? And if I can see the difference between those two things, then I know what's right for me to do, whatever's going to get me to close that gap, right? So whatever closes the gap between imperfection and perfection, perfection means completion, completeness. Whatever closes the gap between imperfection and perfection, that's a virtue. That's a good thing. That's what we want. Whatever disrupts the movement forward toward perfection, that's a vice. That's a problem. So to be virtuous is to close that gap. To be vicious is to interrupt the closing of that gap or the progress that we would make toward that perfection that we're supposed to have. To achieve that perfection, to arrive at what we were always supposed to be, that's virtue. I'm holding up my fingers to do quotes because it's with a capital V. And yeah, I know the difference between quotation marks and a capital V, but it's to emphasize it in some way. You know, this is not just virtue. This is virtue with a capital V. Okay, you get the idea. So look, classical Greek ethics, ethics during the Middle Ages, all the way up through, say, the 1500s, into the 1600s, virtue's the only option. It's the only way we think about ethics. And why that is, we can discuss in another conversation, and we've brought it up before in other conversations about ethics in some of the episodes that we've had before. But the idea is here, the thing that's important is that in the classical Greek sense, and all the way up through the Middle Ages with the Catholic Church and such authority, virtue is the only option for ethics. It's how everybody thinks of it. And it works well because individual perfections, so the goal that I have in mind, the thing I want to become as I think about my virtue and how I pursue what's right and wrong, I've got a goal of getting over there. What gets me there is virtuous. So whatever makes me more like the thing God created me to be makes me more virtuous. Okay, that's fine. But the thing that's important is that as an individual, that doesn't give me a goal that's in opposition to other individuals. If they believe the same God made them with the same kind of essence, and therefore the things they need to do to become virtuous are similar to, or at least compatible with, the things I need to do to become virtuous as well. So the reason classical Greek ethics worked is because they were unified as individuals. The individuals who were pursuing those ethics, those virtues, were unified by their common interest in the village, the city, the polis, the city-state. That's in the Greek culture. Or, later on, in the Middle Ages, for instance, they were unified by the beatific vision, by the blessed vision, the opportunity to see God, the church's statement that if you do these things, then you're the kind of person who can be a part of the community that will one day stand before God and be blessed in the city of God, and so on. This is the idea. So we're unified by this common goal, whether it's established by the city-state in Sparta or differently by the city-state in Athens. It unifies the Athenians, or it unifies the Spartans, or it unifies the Christians. And if you don't want to be unified, then that's fine. You can either be outcast or killed. Those are your other options if you don't want to be a part of the system. So I know that's a harsh way to say it, but I mean, think about the history of the world, and this is how we did it. We unified around a common vision, and that's the direction that we went. Okay, fine. 1600s come along, the Enlightenment, and individualism emerges during that Enlightenment, or from the Enlightenment, whichever way you want to say it, and there's no more unified perfection. Now, of course, it takes time. Maybe it takes a couple of hundred years before it matures, even in the United States, which is growing into its own union during that time. But everyone ends up having their own purpose, their own end, their own goal. It's the very definition of personal liberty, which, by the way, the concept of being a liberal originally means a person who values individual liberties and your ability to have your own goals that are outside the will of the church, because it's not defined by the church. It's defined by you as an individual. And in a lot of ways, early on, the presumption is that that makes us stronger as a society, because individuals can bring their full creativity to bear when they're no longer being squashed or suppressed by the repressive environments that are imposed by what would have been the city-state in the Greek culture, but didn't exist by this time, but by the church later on. And so there's a lot of literature written to make that point, that the individual bursts out and in the creative genius of their individual liberties provide a better place for society and so on like that. So the problem is that once everyone has their own purpose or end or their own goal in mind, it's called a telos, in case I bring that word out later, which is, that again, the definition of personal liberty, that you have your own end, your own goal. You decide where you want to live. You decide what's important to you, the freedom to pursue your own ends. Once everyone has that, There's no more commonality to the ethics of society. I mean, these people want to go this direction. These people want to go that direction. And if those come to a loggerheads, if they create some kind of conundrum or crisis in society, then you don't have an automatic solution, because there's a God in heaven who's saying, well, the way this resolves is you follow your virtue this way, you follow your virtue that way. You don't have that because not everybody wants to worship God. And you don't have it because not everybody agrees that society should be governed by the governments by the government that is the smallest possible government. And not everybody agrees that we should be governed by the government that takes over the entire economy and, you know, parts everything else out at the will of the legislators. We don't agree on it. And therefore, we have these enormous conflicts that break down the concept that, hey, as long as we're all moving toward a common goal, the further we get toward that goal, we're just virtuous. Because then we say to each other, but what's the goal? And we don't agree on what the goal is. And you can see that being played out in our society right now by people who have completely divergent goals. At best, they're divergent. I mean, purely divergent goals. We just go our separate ways and never meet. Unfortunately, they're divergent in one sense, and yet the globe is round, and so we run into each other on the other side of our, you know, ethical globe that we're talking about here. So what, you know, what do we do with that? Well, we develop other forms of ethics. I'm not going to go into those right now. They're not important to us. They're hugely important to me. I love the topic, but that's not our goal for today. So, you know, utilitarianism develops out of it. David Hume first, then John Stuart Mill, developing these concepts that we ought to make judgments about ethics, which for them was largely parliamentary. You know, what laws should we pass? What are the governing rules of society? That we base those on what's effective, what's going to bring about the best result for the most people, for the greatest period of time, and so on. There's that, utilitarianism. In response to that is an Immanuel Kant who comes along. I've done a whole conversation about this in a different episode. But an Immanuel Kant who comes along and says, well, that's not ethics. That's just how do I, you know, obtain happiness for myself? Ethics is, what's the right thing to do? What does autonomy dictate is the law for all people on the basis of their own rationality and so on. And so, which I love, by the way. Again, I really want to talk about that, but that's not the goal today. So Kant comes along. He's got his way of pursuing it. But, you know, there's a frustration in all of those efforts that comes to a head in the existentialism of the 20th century and sort of an abandonment of any absolute right or wrong or concept of ethics. And so we end up with, you know, I mean, some people, there are so much more nuance to add to this. I'm caricaturing based on the way a lot of people would describe this. And so we end up with nothing but relativism and situation ethics and things like that. And so it's all of no value whatsoever. And we have no good ethics that we're pursuing. And we've lost the whole basis for why we would do right to begin with. And Alistair MacIntyre, a mid to late 20th century philosopher, comes up with a way to rescue virtue. To rescue virtue as a concept in a society where you could still have individual liberties. And so what MacIntyre does is what I want to describe to you, because it really is the only reasonable way for us to make a sincere effort at pursuing virtue. I don't mean that philosophically. There is no other concept that could be applied. But I mean, it is a very reasonable way for us to understand and sort of regain in our culture an appreciation for why virtue would be worth pursuing. And so in this very basic text in which he deals with it, it's a book called After Virtue, and you get the irony of the title, After Virtue, meaning virtue's over with, it's done, and yet we're pursuing virtue, we're after virtue. You know, it's a really nice title. In that book, he deals with how to resurrect the concept of virtue in our liberty-based, rights-based society. And so now what's happened as a result of that is that a lot of Christian ethicists see themselves as virtue ethicists. But often we do this without considering the inherent tension between the need for, you know, without understanding why we abandoned virtue ethics for a couple of hundred years. You know, that's the core of what I'm about to say. But it amounts to this. They say, oh, yeah, we should be pursuing virtue ethics. That's what we should be doing. But they're not really thinking about the tension that exists between the need, if you're going to pursue virtue as your ethics, the need for a common end or purpose or goal. You have to have something to tie the society together. Ethics is never just about an individual. Ethics is public. Ethics is about how we live together, why you're obligated to do certain things. And so for us to adopt a virtue ethic without recognizing that we need a shared telos, a shared end, the original, and because the original meaning, again, of ethics is not how to live, but how to live together. And so they haven't considered the inherent tension that exists between virtue's requirement that we have a common telos and then the hegemony, you know, the total overarching power of individualism in a free society. Individualism means you don't have a common telos. I mean, you can say, well, the common telos is the supremacy of the individual. Yeah, I mean, but that's a little bit of wordplay. I don't mean wordplay like it's cheapening the idea, but I mean, it is sort of saying, well, just de facto, because individualism is the thing you want, you have a common telos, which is individualism. But every individual is going his own direction by definition. That's the point of the individualism. And so I don't want to have that argument. I do want to have the argument. You can tell. I get pulled into these philosophical parts of the discussion. But the point is, if we don't pay attention, if we don't give attention to the tension that exists between us having a shared telos which unites our pursuit of virtue, and us valuing individuals being able to make their own choices about their own ends, if we don't grasp the tension that exists between those two things, then we're not going to have a meaningful form of virtue as our ethic. And I'm not a virtue ethicist, meaning I'm not a person who believes that virtue is the only and best way to think about ethics. But I do value it, and I know that it has an inherent value in our concept of what's right and wrong. So I'm going to speak about it from that perspective. If you really want to understand my ethics, we'll go back and talk about it in terms of Kantian ethics and all that that I've done before. But for now, here's the thing. For if you're Catholic, if you're listening to this and you're Catholic, you have a somewhat less severe form of the problem because of the emphasis that the Catholic Church puts on Thomism and on the authority of the community. Now, in American Catholicism, that's different because Americans are so individualistic that even when they are Catholic, they're barely, you know, really committed to the community. I don't mean that insultingly. I mean it sincerely. As a person who respects a lot of people who are very faithful in their practice of Catholicism, that's fine. I'm not a Catholic. I'm not a Catholic for a reason. All that's a different discussion, too. We don't need to get into it. I respect the position of many Catholics in their relationship to the church, to the Pope, and to each other. That's beautiful. It is easier for Catholics to understand virtue ethics because of the importance of Thomas Aquinas. I called it Thomism a moment ago. That's named after Thomas Aquinas. Because of the importance of Thomas Aquinas in Catholic theological and philosophical history, and Thomas Aquinas just imitates Aristotle deliberately, overtly. That's not an insult. That's Aquinas's goal. He takes Aristotle and he applies him to Catholicism. I mean, the term for it that I've given before on a different episode is he baptizes Aristotle, right? So that's, in the Catholic world, you know, an invitation to grasp what virtue ethics is about and to be united around that sort of common vision. That's fine. It doesn't eliminate the difficulties of the challenges, but it makes it easier. McIntyre, I believe, now comes from a Catholic perspective. I think that's correct, that he's Catholic. Some Protestants jump on board with that idea, with the virtue ethics, but Protestantism's entanglement historically and ideologically with the Enlightenment is the source of individualism. Protestantism's entanglement with the Enlightenment makes it practically self-contradictory for Protestants genuinely to embrace virtue ethics. Because we value, just think of it in Baptist theology, and this is something I value. I'm not being critical of Protestant theology here. I'm just assessing it from this objective standard to say we value individualism so much that in Baptist theology, the priesthood of the believer is largely interpreted to mean the individualism that's given to us as believers so that we relate one-to-one with God. And so we prioritize the passages. Every one of us shall give account of himself to God. We prioritize the passages that say there's one mediator between God and men, the man Christ Jesus. And we mean by men, every individual man. We always read it that way as Protestants, or always, we very significantly read it that way as Protestants, because our theology and history blend us with the individualism of the Enlightenment. So again, it makes it more of a challenge for Protestants to think of virtue in this way. I'm not saying it makes Protestants worse. I'm not saying it makes Catholics better. I'm saying it gives a different relationship to those two groups with virtue. That's the point I'm making. But we still have to deal with it, because the reality is we have to answer the question, why is it that I want to arrive at being a better person? Theologically, I've got easy answers. I'm commanded to be righteous, using the churchy language. I'm commanded to be just, using socially conscious language. I'm commanded to be virtuous, using more specifically philosophical language. The words justice and righteous are exactly the same word, dikai in Greek. The word righteousness or just, those are exactly the same word in Greek, dikaiosune. So we're not talking about different concepts. I'm just giving it to different audiences to say, whichever word you prefer to use, you can't get around the fact that at the end of the day, this is the thing God is dealing with us about that needs to be fixed. And if that's the case, if Christ died so that he could make men just, if the gift that we receive in salvation is justness, righteousness, because there is none righteous. Yet when we come to him, he makes us righteous, imputed righteousness as the core of our theology. If all of those things are the case, then we got to figure out some way to deal with this. So what McIntyre proposes, and this is back in the 1980s, I mean, we're talking 40 years ago, are some ways for enlightened individuals to see themselves with a telos broader than the self-serving ambitions of a purely libertine way of thinking about life. Let me restate that. What McIntyre proposes 40 years ago in this book called After Virtue, and again, I there are so many more nuances to this. I get it. I love the book. I wrote part of my dissertation out of some of the product of this book. It's, you know, it's important to me. But I don't think I'm cheapening it to say this part, though. What McIntyre proposes are some ways for those of us who value individualism and liberty, and therefore different ends for different people, to still grasp something that unites us in a way that allows us to serve a telos broader than our self-serving ambitions. So that there's a way for us to come back together and say, oh, we can have a common virtue. We can have something that gives us a reason to pursue something. And it requires at least three concepts. And how these relate to each other is part of the nuance of the conversation that you can find by reading that book or whatever you want to do to get there. Or we can have another conversation another day. Send me an email and I'll do another show on it. Ooh, I'd love to do that. Anyway, the three ideas that are the three concepts, contexts is really what they are, that provide the ability for even an individualist society to still have pursuit of virtue, that we're trying to move from where we are to where we ought to be without having to dictate to everybody what they ought to be, although we have to in order to have a common telos, right? So how do you resolve that? Well, number one, by acknowledging, and you have to acknowledge three things. Number one, by acknowledging the narrative of a human life. So you do have to start with the premise that you're going to have one life, that you are a person who's going to exist throughout your life, and that from being the immature thing you are at the beginning to the mature thing you are at the end is all one process. It's all one story. So the narrative of human life, you can understand why that would be important, because that's the only way you can say, oh, I'm not just knee-jerking from one day to the next. I'm not just reacting to my circumstance from one day to the next. And I'm not just reinventing myself every day. But instead, I'm making progress toward a goal. If I'm making progress toward a goal, then I can talk about improvement. I can talk about a telos. I can talk about an end or a goal or a purpose. Even if I change during the middle of this story, I still want to acknowledge that the me that existed before this change is the same me that exists now, and that this change actually makes me better, not just different, but better. So the narrative of human life has to be a part of the picture if we're going to have a pursuit of virtue, right? Number two, and again, these are just my very simple translations of what I understand from Alistair McIntyre's After Virtue, which there's a lot to follow from that. I mean, there are a lot of other philosophers who've written on it since then. He sort of resurrected the concept and created a cottage industry of virtue philosophers. So, you know, yay to Alistair McIntyre for doing so. Number two, second context that has to be present, is that of a discipline or a craft or a trade or a skill. That is that we're not just selfishly developing things, but you know, we learn something from other people, and what we learn from other people, we don't want to just take and leave it stagnant or make it worse. You know, well, yeah, I learned how to play football from my coach, but I've really cheapened the game since then, and it's a whole lot more fun now. You know, nobody would do that. I mean, the whole object is to make it better, to learn to run faster from your track coach, to be able to set higher goals, to be able to develop a better method. Nobody says, you know, well, we finally got this really great way to do the high jump, whatever the flop is called, you know. But now let's go back to the old way and let's do it worse than we used to do it. Nobody's going to do that. You want to make it better. So within a discipline, within an expertise, like playing chess or golf, you understand that there are rules to follow and there are standards to keep that go beyond you. They're part of the discipline. So if you want to be a part of this discipline, if you're going to be a chess player, you don't move the pieces when the other people are not looking, when the opponent's not looking. You don't cheat. You know, you move the pieces when other people are looking. And if you lose, you say, oh, well, that's okay because it helps me to be a better chess player for next time. And that goes back to the narrative of human life, right? So it's the context of a specific discipline or a craft or a trade or a skill that needs to be present with us. And then number three is the context of a historical tradition. And this one is really important. It's the only one I want to really talk about today. The historical tradition that I wasn't born into a vacuum. I was born into a tradition. People had created these things that were handed to me as a child and which I'm expected to hand to the generations that follow me. And our expectation is that we would hand it to the next generation in better shape than we received it. That's the nature of a historical tradition. And those can be specific. like the historical tradition of theology or in the church, like I was talking about a moment ago, or they can be much broader, the society of American culture and so on. Whatever it is, that context of a historical tradition is what I want to talk about. In the context of a historical tradition, we would understand, it would come automatically, and so virtue becomes easy to resurrect, that our pursuit of virtue cannot just be about us as individuals. I mean, that's as simple as knowing that we picked up this narrative, the historical tradition, in media res. That is, in the middle of things, you know, like you would, like some plays open in the middle of things, or a short story opens in the middle of things. That's how your life opened. You think, no, my life began with my birth. Well, obviously not, because somebody gave you birth and existed before you, and somebody gave them birth. You woke up right in the middle of things. And the middle of things implies that there were those who went before us. And you can just say family. You can start there. Your family is included. But it's not just your family. It's social structures, the economy, the values that we receive in our culture, the religion that we're handed from our parents, the traditions that we receive from them or from our public school or private school or homeschool groups or from whatever, wherever we receive our traditions. And those traditions include positive things, these sacrifices or heroics or successes from our history. Here's George Washington on the Potomac crossing the river and the great victory in American Revolution and the founding of the nation. But it also includes selfishness and cowardice and failures. We know the name Benedict Arnold, not to pick on anybody from his family if you grew up in his family. I'm just saying. No pride. Nobody, you know, that's just not, nobody's naming their kid. Well, maybe you did, but I'm just saying that's weird. Not weird. It's fine. You name them what you want. But, you know, we have those traditions that recognize our failures, the negative side of who we are as well. It's part of our story. Look what we overcame. So when we look back on the civil rights movement, we're naming our streets, right? Rosa Parks Boulevard. We want to recognize the successes and the heroics, but in doing so, we have to recognize the things that they overcame as well. So ultimately, our pursuit of virtue requires that we recognize and measure the difference between what we know we ought to be, we know we ought to have been in some cases, and what we actually are. So by recognizing the difference between what we, for instance, let's put it in the past tense, between what we ought to have been and what we actually have been, when we recognize those differences, then we can appreciate the progress that we've made since, right? And in the same sense, when we look at it in the present tense, if we are able to recognize and measure the difference between what we know we ought to be and what we actually are, then we're able to set goals. We're able to aim for something, for where we ought to obtain. This is the only way to practice the virtues and to lead us, both individually and corporately. It's the only way to lead us toward the perfection that we are supposed to be pursuing, our perfection, our completion. But a perfection which does define the path along which virtues guide us to be better is essential to us. Otherwise, we become stagnant or we become worse. That's the worst of all things. So fine, in this lifetime, I may not be able to obtain perfection. I acknowledge that. I mean, I know that. I believe that. Eschatologically, I believe it because of what I think the end of time is and when Christ comes and the fulfillment of faith and all those things. I believe in that. I don't believe I'm going to obtain perfection in this life. But perfection does define the path, to say it again, along which those virtues guide us, guide me, to be better instead of to be stagnant or to be even worse. So you can hear why I'm saying the only hope we have for virtue is the possibility of improvement. That's the only way virtue can be a part of our ethic. Is if we recognize that there is a gap between where we are right now and where we ought to be. So the possibility of improvement is in the recognition of our imperfections. So as an individual, I look at myself and I say, where are my imperfections? Well, I don't know. I mean, if I knew where my imperfections were, I would be addressing them, right? That this is the goal that every person has. And you can say, no, some people just want to do the wrong thing. Well, they're viewing that as a part of their goal. That's part of the outcome that they have in mind. For we're pursuing what we think is the right thing for us to do in the moment. There's a way that seems right unto a man, even when the end thereof are the ways of death. I added the even then, but it makes the point from the proverb, right? So as individuals, we look for our imperfections. Well, one of the worst things not to know is what you don't know, right? So how do you do it? Well, you're reading books and you're listening to your preacher on Sunday and your journey group leader or Sunday school teacher or whatever you call your small group discipler. You're picking up conversations from other people, paying attention to media and entertainment and listening and saying, oh, was I aware of that? Did I know this thing? Have I turned off my empathy for certain kinds of people in our society and so on? So as individuals, recognizing where something might be wrong is essential for us to be able to pursue virtue. And as a society, exactly the same thing is true. Whether this is corporate or personal, the idea of the virtue doesn't change. The idea that we as a society would think that we have obtained utopia would not only be presumptuous, but it would preclude us from being able to improve. And we don't want that. So discussing, this idea of hope, that we have hope, that we have possibility, that we have room for improvement, therefore also means that we have need. Now, there's the strangest thing happens in the conversations I have, in the groups that I'm in the circles that I'm in. And in the circles that I'm in, when I say this about abortion, for instance, when I say it's terribly wrong that we devalue the lives of little babies in the womb, the people I'm around, they think that's fine. Oh, good. Point out the flaws in our society. You should do that, and we should try to improve those things because they know we should be better than we are. What's funny is in a lot of the groups that I'm in, not all, but in a lot of the groups that I'm in, when I bring the same thing up about racism or I bring the same thing up about inequalities regarding women, I get stares like, you don't value our society? What, you don't think we're good enough? No, I love our society. I value our society, but I also know we're not perfect. We have not obtained the perfection that could be in front of us. I'm not saying that we would ever be utopian, but I am saying we should be moving along that path. That's what perfection is for. That's what the virtue is for, to pull us forward to do better. And I think it's funny, when you think about it, what are the reasons people are so resistant to some of these conversations? And I'm choosing conversations sometimes. In one circle, it's a conversation about abortion that people are resistant to. In another circle, it's a conversation about racism or about gender equality that people are resistant to. But in either case, the resistance does come back to saying, you don't think we're good enough? I think we're good. We're going the right direction. Why are you stopping us? And so on. And the reasons for resistance, I think, sometimes are confusing. So, for instance, what's purported to be the reason for resistance that I get sometimes is this statement. Well, the cross is sufficient. Let's just focus on the cross. Let's just focus on the gospel. Why would we do everything else? But if that were in truth the cause for the resistance, then it would come up when I'm bringing up the other issue with that group. So, for instance, the ones who say it when I bring up racism would bring it up about Roe v. Wade. They would have brought it up for all those years that I was talking about the social injustice of Roe v. Wade. But we didn't. That wasn't the thing. Hey, the cross is sufficient. Let's not worry about abortion. We didn't say that. We thought it was a good idea to talk about. And so what I would ask is this. The cross is sufficient. Of course the cross is sufficient to bring justification. But what about the leaking pipe in your bathroom? So I got water dripping out of the ceiling in my bathroom. This is not true. I'm making this up. I have water dripping out of the ceiling in my bathroom. Hey, the cross is sufficient. Pray, share the gospel. That'll do the job. No, I mean, when I have a leaky pipe, I address the leaky pipe. And then I thank the Lord for the provision he's given me to have the patience to deal with a leaky pipe. The thing I'm saying is our faith is not an excuse. And I've said this before. Our faith is not an excuse for ducking the things we ought to make better in this world. We have a responsibility. This is the point of James, and it's what James is saying. And he's saying it in the context of righteousness, virtue, justness, justice for people who are excluded. He says it in that context in the second chapter of James. What good is it, my brothers, he says, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can that faith save him? I'm just the messenger. I'm reading the words. Just listen to what James said. The Bible's sufficient or is not? Here's what the Bible says. If a brother or sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warmed and filled, without giving them the things needed for the body, what good is that? So also faith, if it does not have works, is dead. It's a metaphor. It's not just about giving clothes to the poor. It is about giving clothes to the poor, because he uses that specific example at the beginning of James 2, at the beginning of the chapter. But he's using that metaphor to say we can't use our faith as an excuse for not addressing the imperfections that are present in us in this world. And so in actuality, this is the cause for the much resistance that we face, and all of us do face it. All of us want to say to people who are telling us what's wrong with us, don't tell me what's wrong with me. The reality is, when there's a call for improvement, you know, you can be better in this way. A lot of times people are mystified when they share the good news of salvation with someone. And the response is negative. Like, don't tell me that. I don't want to hear that. And they shut the door in your face. And it's like, well, all I've got is good news for you. Well, it sounds like good news to you, but built into it is the statement, you know, you're not good enough. And Christ can make you better. And so I think that applies to us as well as it applies to the people who are outside of the faith. The call for improvement implies a recognition of our flaws. And we don't like to be criticized. I think that's a real part for the reason, one of the reasons at least, for our resistance. And also this, the call for improvement implies a call for change. And the danger of change is that when you change one thing, other things might also change. And we're a little afraid about that. So like the leaky faucet I was talking about, or a pipe that's leaking. If I go to fix a pipe, and I don't, I just call a plumber. If I go to fix a pipe, I'm going to break the pipe in the wall. So it's worse than it was before. And that's what a lot of us are thinking about these challenges that we face when people say you ought to do better. We ought to pursue justice. We ought to pursue righteousness. We ought to pursue virtue, which means the same thing. That when people say that, our response is, no, you just don't appreciate how good we are. What they're saying is, look, I get it. There's a small leak, but there's no reason to tear the wall out. I mean, come on, we can live with this. But our only options are these two, and I'll be done. Our only options are these two. Number one, that we decide we are already good enough and refuse to make any more changes. So we're just good enough. Or that we decide we're never going to stop improving, that we are always going to work harder at perfecting our union. Can I read you the opening line to the Constitution? This is our preamble. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union. That's the language. In order to form a more perfect union, to establish justice, to ensure domestic tranquility, to provide for the common defense, everyone's, to promote the general welfare, everyone's, to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution. The underlying fundamental principle of our society's establishment, not an inspired document, but a really great establishment of a union, is that we form a more perfect union. Not a perfect union, a more perfect union. And so we have to decide that we are always going to work harder at perfecting our union, all the while knowing we will not arrive, but are always getting closer.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.